Hello everyone, welcome to iOS App Development with Swift. I'm Dan Armendariz, I'm preceptor of computer science here at School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. And Swift is actually kind of a really neat language, and I have some plans for today. So over the next hour or so, we're going to look at iOS App Development itself using Xcode and actually creating some very basic, very simple applications, and looking at the ability, the way that you actually take those applications and build them and actually put them on an iOS device. Some of the things that we're not going to look at will include things like actually taking an application and putting it on the App Store. There's a lot of tutorials online that will help you with that aspect of it, but also because as part of CS50, you get to join the Apple development team, CS50's app development team. If you haven't done that yet and you are affiliated with CS50, I do recommend that you do that, because that is how you're able to create some programs in Xcode, build them, and actually put them on some of your iOS devices if you actually have a physical iOS device. If you don't have a physical iOS device, that's more than fine. You can actually develop for iOS, and they have Xcode has a simulator that allows you to see your application in action on your computer, but it sort of is a neat thing to actually play and interact with your application on an actual device. So there's a couple of requirements to actually do all of this development. One of them is that you have to have a Mac. It has to be running 10.9.4 or later in order to do development with Swift. You can use an earlier version to develop with Objective-C for iOS and Mac. But I recommend, in a lot of the examples that we'll see today, use 10.10 Yosemite. So if you haven't yet upgraded, it's a good excuse to do so. Now, Xcode 6.1 is the latest version of the integrated development environment that Apple provides for free that you can download off the App Store. And I recommend that you also run the latest version. If you happen to be running an earlier version, Xcode 5 and below just simply do not support Swift whatsoever. And the beta versions of 6, which were released over the summer, do support Swift, but there's been an enormous number of changes in the language, enough so that the code that you're going to look at and that you might find on the internet will not actually compile properly in these prior versions of Xcode. So again, if you don't yet have a developer account, I recommend you go to developer.apple.com, sign up, create a developer account, and join the CS50 app development team. That will provide to you an opportunity to compile your applications and put them on your device. Okay, so let's get started. The very first thing we're going to do is to actually create a very simple project in Xcode that will allow you to make an application. So if you don't yet have Xcode open, go ahead and open it and create a new project. A special splash screen will open and will give you some options about what it is that you want to do. Just say that you want to create a new project, a new application. This window will pop up, assuming you're using Xcode 6.1. Right now, and for the duration of this seminar, we're going to be using single view applications, just sort of a basic application to get your feet wet, and you can branch out on your own from there. Click Next at this point. Now here, there's a couple of things that you might want to enter. The product name is the name of your project. In this case, I'm just going to call it Seminar 1 because it's our first example. Organization name, in this case, it's just my name. You can, of course, change it to your own name or to CS50. Organization identifier, if you happen to have a website, just take the domain name in reverse, com.yourname. And then the name of the product should appear automatically after that as the bundle identifier. Obviously, the language that we're going to be using for today is Swift. You can, of course, use Objective-C for that, but today will be Swift. And we'll, for now, say universal devices so that it works on both iPad and iPhone, and we will leave core data unchecked to keep the project relatively simple for the time being. So let's go ahead and click Next. And it's going to ask me where I want to save it. I'll just save it to my desktop for now. All right, so now this is what will happen when you actually open Xcode. And notice that the very first thing you see is this exclamation point that says no signing identity found. I'm hoping I intentionally did this on my computer, and I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to actually fix it, because I want you to see how this will actually work on your own machine. Go ahead and click fix issue. It will ask you if you want to, if you have an existing Apple developer account. This is where joining the CS50 app development team is important, so that you not only have an app account, but you also have the capability to sign the apps and put them on your iOS device. Clicking fix issue is not necessary if you're just going to build and develop locally, entirely within the iOS simulator. But for now, I'm going to develop and put them on my iPad, which we'll be able to broadcast as well. So I do want to actually add this, and it's going to ask me for my Apple ID. So it's going to be this. And I have to fetch my password, which is over here. So give me just 1 second to find that. And copy that and paste it over here. Click add. It's going to ask me which team I want to join. I'm going to do school of engineering. Click join. And whoops, that's the wrong one. Let's do this one. Hopefully that one will work. Nope, that one still doesn't work. Uh-oh, we're running out of good ones here. Okay, this one should work. I'll close that. Now let's do school of engineering, click choose. And now hopefully after a couple of seconds, okay, I'll revoke and request. Damn, oh man, this is gonna not work. Okay, I'll try a different one. Let's do this one here. And live demos are failing me. We may have to revert to just building entirely locally, but that would be okay in this case. So here, while this is actually working, what we're going to do is just create a very simple Hello World application. So this is Xcode, and if you haven't seen it yet, it can be a little intimidating at first. There's a lot of pains, there's a lot of doodads in various areas, but just realize that there's really several main components to this development environment. On the far left are all of the files that are applicable to your program or to your particular project. We'll be clicking around on some of them and we'll point out the most important ones over time. On the far right, we have a set of attributes, and all of these attributes, there are various panes for the attributes. The panes will change depending on the context of the main content, which happens to be in the middle. Now, the middle can actually show you a variety of things. For example, your code itself, or you might actually have, when you click on the storyboard, which is, by the way, just a graphical representation of your user interface for your application, then the attributes pane on the very far right will actually change. Now, there's a couple of other things that I want to point out. You can sort of explore around in the environment on your own. But one of the things that has been very useful is this button near the top right of the window. There's this button that looks like on the far left, it has a paragraph followed by two circles and two arrows pointing away from each other. If you switch between the standard editor, which is the far left one, the one that's selected by default, and this sort of the two circles overlapping each other, what you actually get are a double pane view. And this is actually going to be useful for us when we need to link items in the UI to the code. And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. But realize that if you get even more panes like this, you can simplify your view just a little bit by clicking back on your live or clicking back on your single editor. So far, so good. So basically, we have the code on the left, attributes on the right, and whatever it is that we're working on here on the very center. So here I've clicked on the main storyboard. And the storyboard, again, is a way in Xcode that you can actually create your user interface using just drag and drop techniques. And so for our very first application, this is precisely what we are going to do. We're going to go down to the very far lower right portion of the screen, which contains a variety of user elements that you can then click and drag to create your user interface. Now, all of these elements are called views because they supply some sort of view. There's an image view, for example, to actually show an image on the user interface. There's a table view to actually show a table, so on and so forth. There's a wide variety of views that you can select here. So just for now, we're going to search for a label. You can just scroll through all of the lists that's there, but there's a search bar at the very bottom that makes it easier to identify specific views that you actually want to drag into your user interface. I found my label. I'm going to drag it here directly onto my sample application. Right there in the middle looks good. I'm going to type hello world, hit enter. Now I have a label. Oop, it doesn't look like it's centered quite properly, so now I can try to recenter it. Fortunately, it offers these guides to make things much easier. I'm going to try to compile it. Hopefully, it will actually work here. And if it does, in just a moment, it will in fact appear on my iPad. It's right here. There it is. Okay. So that's it. We're done. We've created our very first application. Now, obviously, this doesn't do anything. It's just a label. There's no connection between the user interface and the code. So if we actually wanted to create this connection, if we actually wanted to have some sort of communication between the elements that exist on the screen and the code that allows us to control those elements, then we actually need to look at the code itself. So this is what's called viewcontroller.swift. And for, especially for your first few programs, this is going to be sort of the bulk of the code that you enter is going to be in this document here. There's a lot of stuff that's in here so far, right? There's import UIKit class, override func, all these various things, and it's not quite clear what it is that all of this means. So let's take a step back away from Xcode for a little bit and look at the language itself, Swift. So with Swift, it was in design and development at Apple for about 4 years, is my understanding, and there's a couple of features about it that are really neat. First of all, it's a compiled language, just like C. So you first have to compile it and then run it before you can actually execute the code that results. But there is, unlike C, an interactive prompt that you can actually run and type arbitrary commands into, and very much like a JavaScript console, which you may be familiar with now, it actually will evaluate those commands and provide to you the output. And they've even taken that to the next level, and they've created something called playgrounds in Xcode that allow you to visually work with code, and we'll actually see some examples of that in just a little bit. It's based on C. C underlies it because all of the compilers create code out of C and create the object code from it. But it really shares relatively little syntax. It will look fairly different. There will be some similarities, but there are going to be quite a few differences compared to, say, JavaScript or PHP, and we'll point these out in just a moment. Now, one of the biggest things about Swift that's nice is that, especially compared to C, it's meant to be safe. Everything in it is meant to be very strongly typed, and in fact, it's almost annoying at first, when you first start working with Swift, just how much it enforces types everywhere. Anything that's a string has to remain a string. It's very difficult to sort of convert it or coerce it into some other form. And again, we'll show examples of this, but ultimately realize that this is meant to protect you, and by you, I mean your code, from crashing in some horrible way when you have some sort of mismatched type. And again, work with it, because it will be frustrating at first as you try to figure out why exactly you're getting this unusual error dealing with types, but it will be worth it in the end. It does deal with automatic memory management, so no longer do you have to deal with things like malloc and free and all of these sorts of things. And it's also designed for generality, so while we can use it in Xcode to create iOS apps and Mac applications, we can also just use it as a scripting language, and so we can use it sort of instead of PHP or instead of Python to actually quickly parse and process some data that we have on our computer. It has a wide variety of modern features. Optionals, immutability, generics, closures, and a lot of these stuff you may or may not recognize. And it's just sort of an unfortunate part of the language that some of these sort of futuristic modern elements that are contained within the elements are so deeply ingrained that I actually will have to sort of teach you CS50.5 a little bit. We have to learn a little bit more about some of these features in order to really understand what's going on and so that you can look at code and not feel totally lost, and you'll see what I mean by that in just a minute. Okay, so enough of this sort of theoretical stuff. Let's actually look at our very first Swift program. It's one line of code, line 14 right here. It says print ln hello CS50. So there's a couple of things that's very different about this compared to things that you might be used to from C, for example. One of them is that there's no int main. There's no include section. There's none of this extra stuff. The include, like standard I/O, like the libraries that actually provide the standard features of the language, are automatically included as part of Swift's standard library and that are automatically imported. You don't have to do that import manually. Int main doesn't exist because the main entry point for the code is actually at the beginning of the code. So any code that you have starting from the beginning will actually be executed at the start. So this really greatly simplifies it. Notice also that there's no semicolon. There's no semicolons in this language. You put a statement on an individual line, and then the next line represents the other statement. If you want to put multiple statements on a line, then you have to separate it by semicolons. But for the most part, for good style, we're never going to see semicolons for the purposes of separating statements in Swift. So how does this actually work? Well, very much like C, we actually have to compile this. And so we can do that by using Swift C and then 1.swift. And then after a couple of minutes, this will actually this will compile. And then I can run item 1. And then it will just say, hello, CS50. Awesome. So there we go. There's our first Hello World program. Let's move on to number 2. Now, in this, this has changed slightly, because whereas normally you do, in fact always do, you have to compile a Swift application before you actually run it, one of the great features that I alluded to before was that Swift can actually be used in sort of a pseudo-interpreted mode. There is, in fact, like an interpreter. But what this will do is there is, in fact, a Swift application that you can run. So for example, if you just type Swift here, what will happen is that you will get a prompt, and you can type your Swift code, print hello, and run it. And it will actually print, well, it didn't print in this case because it printed to standard out, which is not visible here. But it is actually able to function. And so in this case, I'm just going to use this as a script, and I can actually run this code there. So the way that I actually run it will be slightly different, but you'll see that in just a moment. Now, in this case, what we're going to do is to first define a variable. So this is how we define a variable in Swift, is we use the let keyword followed by the name of the variable, and then we provide some initializing data optionally. So in this case, we're defining a constant called name, and we're going to use that in the output of our print line at the very bottom, hello name. Now notice that rather than using %s, we can encapsulate the name of this variable in \parens, and be able to concatenate in the contents of this string into this string. Now, unlike C, string is an actual real type in Swift, and so it sits alongside ints and alongside doubles very easily and naturally compared to some of the other languages that we've seen. So this would actually function just like you would expect. I can run 2.swift, and you see that my name is actually spliced in. Hello, Dan. Okay, awesome. Moving on to number 3. Now, it was a little bit of a white lie that I said that the way that we declare variables was to use the let keyword. As many times as you possibly can, you do want to use let, because what that does is it defines a constant. And that tells Swift that it can optimize the speed of your application because it knows that that variable is not going to change. So evaluate carefully when you're going to use a variable for the purposes of changing it and when you're going to create a variable just to hold some data. And that is not actually going to change. So this concept of immutability is not actually going to change is an important one, even as far down as defining variables. So here we've defined a name, let name, and in this case it's a constant that is of type string and is equal to Dan. So whereas in the prior version, it inferred, and by it I mean Swift inferred the type of data that we've entered into the variable. In this case, we can be explicit. So let, then the name of this variable is name, then a colon, and after the colon do we specify the type of data. So no longer is it int name or string name or something like that, but instead let label, we're defining whether or not it's constant or variable, followed by the name, followed by the type optionally. So in this case, we're defining this name is a string, we're saying it's Dan, and now I have another variable, in this case it's called label, but notice that it is prefixed with the var keyword. The var keyword means that this variable can be changed at a later point in time. Somewhere down in the code can we actually change it, and it won't give us any particular error. We can do standard concatenating operator here using the plus symbol to actually add our name into this string. And then we can print it out as we saw just a moment ago. Now let's say that you want to create a variable, but you don't want to initialize it yet. You don't yet want to put any data within it. Well, you have to tell Swift what the type of data is going to be before you can actually define it properly. So in this case, when we've defined a variable called grade, we have to be explicit about its type, because it cannot infer it just looking at the initialized data that you provide to it. It will give us an error if you just type var grade, for instance, because it has no type, therefore. So grade equals 100, so the 100 is an integer. It fits very nicely into that. It will continue to function. And we can see how then we can concatenate this in. Now, you might be tempted, if you actually wanted to concatenate the grade into another text string or into another string, that you would just use that same concatenating operator. And that would normally be true, but Swift will not allow you to implicitly change the type of data. So in this case, this line 25 will fail because grade is an integer and not a string. And so there's a mismatched set of types. So you have to be explicit when you want to change this data, when you want to coerce this data into a different type and say, OK, I want to take this grade, which is an integer, and convert it to a string. So I take a capital S string. All of the types that you'll notice are capitalized, int, double, string, so on and so forth. All of them are capitalized, just to make things easier. And you will say capitalized string, pass into it grade, and it will create a string out of that integer. And then we can concatenate the two very nicely. Any questions on this stuff so far? All right, let's plow through to number four. Now, let's talk about some more advanced structures like arrays and loops. And unlike C, arrays in Swift are not represented by pointers. Pointers in Swift, although they exist, it's called like unsafe pointers or something, excuse me, or some similar type like this, they're not exposed to you normally. So it becomes very difficult for you to manipulate the memory directly of your computer. So arrays are just a data type, and they're referenced using this sort of now standard square bracket notation that you've seen before. But when you actually want to define a type of a variable as an array of some particular type, then you put that type in square brackets. So what I'm saying here is that I'm creating a variable called grades of type int array. And I'm setting that equal to some initialized data, which in this case is 100, 0, 90, 85, which is just a collection of arbitrary grades here. Now, in this case, I could, remember, remove the type, and it will be able to infer it based on the initialized data. But if I removed this and I needed to set it later, then I would have to make sure that I have the type there. All right, let's move along. So we can arrays provide to us a variety of methods through that dot notation that you are probably now familiar with. So grades.count, for example, tells us precisely the number of elements that are contained within this array. If I want to add additional, now notice that this is a var and not, this is a variable and not a constant, which means that I can change the contents of this array. I can add objects to it, but I can't just say grades and then in square brackets 4, because that will be an out-of-bounds error in this case. If I want to actually change the size of this array, I have to use the dot append method to add something on to the very end of it. I can, however, change individual indices. So I could use grades and then in square brackets 0 to manipulate this first index and so on, like you would normally expect. And I can do the same to actually receive the data from that as well. Now, there's also sort of a fancy method of doing this, grades plus equals, and then another index, which will append, or not another index, but another list, which will append that list to the back of grades. And grades will then contain all of that. But that's sort of an extra thing that I'm just showing you for fun. Now is a for loop. And this is the start of where things start to change a little bit. Notice how this for loop is different from for loops in C. Now, I will note that for loops in Swift can be made to look like for loops in C, but there's a lot of more useful constructs that essentially eliminate the need to have for var I equals 0, semicolon, I is less than some length, so on and so forth, right? And this construct is just one of them. For index. Index is a new variable in this case. In range, and what I'm saying is that there's a range from 0 all the way up to, but not including, grades.count. So this dot dot less than sign represents a range of values starting from 0 all the way up to grades.count minus 1. There is a separate operator that exists, which is dot dot dot, which would mean that I want the range of 0 to grades count inclusive. But in this case, because these arrays are 0 index, we of course do not want to go to the maximum number of grades. I can sum the grades, as you might expect, and output all of this stuff. OK, moving on. Now, let's talk about functions. In order to define a function, you use the func keyword. And again, in Swift, you have to be very careful with the types. You provide to it parameters by defining, for example, the name of the parameter, and then in colon, the type of data that you expect that parameter to accept. So in this case, we have a function called printGradeCount. It accepts a variable called gradebook, or rather a parameter called gradebook, and we are expecting that gradebook to be an array of integers. That gradebook is empty, we'll print one thing. Otherwise, we will print out the number of grades that this actually has. Now, if we want to return some value, then the way that we modify this definition is to actually use this arrow keyword, or to use this arrow signifier. So here we're going to define a function called average. We're going to accept in a list of numbers, and we're going to return a double, which will hopefully be the average of this array. And in order to do that, in order to actually calculate this average, we will take a sum, and we will, of course, sum up all of the objects within this array. Notice that there is a new style of for loop here. We don't have to be explicit about iterating over every single element, but we can instead say for grade and gradebook, meaning that for every single item that we have in this, provide that item in this variable called grade, and I want to do something with it. So I'm going to sum all of this data and actually return the double division. Now notice again here, there's the concept of integer division in Swift. If you want to do double division because you want decimals, then you have to be explicit, not just about one side, because it's not going to allow you to coerce data on either side of this. You have to actually coerce both sides into doubles so that you're very explicit about making sure that you're doing double division. Let's move on. So if I actually want to accept, so in this particular example, this is still a command line-based application, and we're starting to see some of the limitations of the Young language in that although we can access the arguments by using this process.arguments, it's still not necessarily the cleanest thing that we've ever seen. But basically, I encourage you to sort of look at this code and try to figure out what exactly is going on. Essentially, what's happening is that we're taking a list of arguments and we're coercing them into integers, and then we're going to use that as a way to print out the average of all of our grades. Moving on. Now, there's another type of data, another data type rather than arrays called dictionaries, which are very similar to hash tables or hash maps and are similar also to PHP's associative arrays. So they have the notion of keys and values, and they're defined also with this square bracket notation, but the difference is that dictionaries have inside of the square bracket a colon. And the colon separates the data type that is the key and the value. So in this case, I'm going to create a dictionary to accept some grades, and it is going to be of type string colon int, which means that all of the keys are going to be strings, and all of the values of those keys are going to be integers. What this means is that I can then reference the specific data that I want using those keys rather than using numeric indices like I would have for a standard array. Now, let's see. There's one important thing that I also want to mention about this particular sequence of code, and that is that there is another type of data, or rather, there's this idea of data that is contained within Swift called optionals. And what optionals means is that it acknowledges the fact that sometimes you're not going to get the data that you actually expect. And so what I mean by that is, let's take a look at this sequence of code, which iterates over all of the arguments that were passed to this code and tries to convert them, tries to split into a variety of strings because it accepts a very particular type of argument. And then it is going to try to coerce the strings that represent numbers into integers that are grades that I can then compute. So basically, I'm going to use this split function that exists within the Swift standard library. I'm going to pass into it the string that I want to split. And then in using this sort of funky syntax, which I don't know if we'll get to, but maybe, we'll actually specify the precise character that we want to split at. So what does this actually look like? Let's take a look at actually running this code. So for example, let's say I have a quiz, and I got a 50 on that, and I have a PSAT, and I got 100 on that, and there's another quiz, and I got a 40 on that. I hit enter. And eventually what will happen is that it's taking these parameters, splitting the strings at these colons, recognizing that there's two elements in each one, and it's essentially keeping track of each. So I have in my dictionary a quiz whose value is represented by the number 50. I have a PSET that has a value of 100 and a quiz 1 which has a value of 40. then later on in the code, I actually average all of those values and list all of the keys of that particular dictionary. But this is important so that you can notice what is happening, is that what we want to do is to take this string and split it at this character, which we can do, again, with this split function using this sort of interesting syntax that exists here. Just for now, assume that that's OK. We'll look more at this in just a little while. But now, there's an interesting aspect that we actually want to try to convert this string into an integer. But in other languages, what might happen is that we would probably try to do it and either get back some sort of sentinel value, like negative 1 or maybe a null or something like that, or maybe it would just cause an error. And we would have to then catch that error and then try to do something based on the fact that this conversion to an integer failed. That's where this idea of optionals comes in. You can actually create a data type that is an int question mark, for example, which means that if this is that means that this integer is in fact optional. And what will happen is that it may contain an integer, or it may not. It may in fact be this other idea entirely called nil, in which it means that there's no value whatsoever in this. It's not even zero. There's just no value. There's absolutely no value represented. And that is what this line 71 is doing, is that it is saying that I want to try to set a value, or a variable called grade, equal to the conversion of this string into an int. So I've taken this string, this first component, or rather the second component, because this is zero indexed, of this string that I've split, and I want to convert that to an integer. But it may not always proceed normally, because imagine what would happen if rather than type a number, I type, of course, like ASDF. It's going to fail. It's not actually going to be able to convert that to an integer as I would expect. So rather than kick off some sort of an error, we have this idea of an optional. And that means that using this question mark, I can say, OK, is it possible that I can take this, convert it into an int, and put it into a variable, which will also be an int? If so, then that means that this was successful, and this first portion of the block can continue. Otherwise, it failed. There is no value in grade, or rather, there is no value in existing, and I actually have to try to handle this error condition. You're going to see this question mark all the time in Swift and in example code for Swift. And in fact, the nil operator, this sort of question mark, the optionals part is going to be probably one of the more difficult things to sort of wrap your head around as you actually work with it. It might make sense now. And in fact, when I was writing sample code for this, it certainly, like, I understood what was going on, but still caught me by surprise every so often when I would find that some data was actually a nil version, an optional version of the data that I was expecting. So just realize that if you have an optional version, you have to unpack that data from this box. So it's sort of like, imagine if you have a box, and it contains something. And what you need to do is to ask the question, is it possible that this box actually contains the data that I'm looking for? If so, then pull that data out and put it into this variable existing. If not, then I just have to disregard the contents of this box altogether because it literally contains nothing. Any questions on this? OK, let's move away from this sort of command line-based thing and start looking at some of the technology that Xcode provides to us in the form of playgrounds. So there's a lot of capability here with Swift. And if you open up Xcode and it asks you what you want to do, you can open up a playground and just play around with a lot of different structures and aspects of the language before you even start touching the iOS SDK or the Mac SDK. So in this case, let's say that I have a relatively contrived example here, but bear with me as we sort of work through this example. Let's say that we have to do a lot of exponents with a fixed value. Like, we know that we're going to need to do a lot of square powers, for example. So we're going to take some value x, we're going to square it. We're going to take some value y, we're going to square it, so on and so forth. Now, we might actually just create a power of 2 function for this, right? So we create a power of 2 function, we'll accept a double, we'll output, or we'll return a double type. We'll take this result, and then for twice, will we actually take take the result, which was initialized to value of 1, and multiply it by x. So in essence, we have x times x here. Right, and so then I can then, as we might expect, take this run power of 2, provide to it some data like 2.0, and we get to see the results here, 4.0. Run power of 2 on 3.2, and we get to see our result, 10.24. So far, so good, right? Now we're thinking, well, OK, now I actually need to do a lot of powers of 3. So I'll copy-paste all of this code, change the name of the function from power of 2 to power of 3, and everything will be the same except for this value here, this range, 1 dot 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 2. So rather than repeating this loop twice, I want to repeat this loop 3 times. So I just change that value from 1 to 3, or rather from 2 to 3. So again, same code, that's the only change. Now this also works. Power of 3 provided in some value of 2, we get 8, so 2 cubed, and 3.2 cubed is 32.768, and so far so good, right? But hopefully this is a little bit of a red flag for you in that we now have some duplication of code, except for some very minor change from one to the next. So is there some way that we might be able to simplify this problem, where we can actually, at runtime, figure out some, provide to us some function that has precisely the power of that we want? And there's this idea of closures, which is really, really important in the context of Swift and in many other languages as well. But probably you will see it used more so in Swift because it's embedded within the language than you will in other also modern languages. So the idea of a closure is this, is that we can have a function that is meant to be a generic function, a generic power of function. And this function is going to accept this exponent that we actually want to create. So for example, the very first instance, we wanted a power of 2. So we would provide power of, and then in parentheses, 2. And now notice what this actually returns. This takes an input of a parameter called y that is an integer, and it returns this crazy-looking thing in parentheses, parentheses, double, and then arrow, double. What this means is that I am going to return a function. I'm not returning another type of data. I'm, in fact, returning a function that has this parameter that accepts a double as input and outputs a double as a return value. And as a result, because now I've called power of, passing in some value for y, and I'm creating this other function, notice that there's another function that's being created inside of this, what I am doing is I can then change that value, that one value that I had changed from 2 to 3, I now make it y, and this persists. So every time that I call, when I call power of, essentially what happens is that I get returned a function. Notice that here, I've defined a new variable called square. I've set it equal to power of, provided this value 2 to power of, and what this returned is the function. So square, the variable square, is now of type function that has this, oops, scroll up a little bit, that has this signature, accept a double and output a double. So now what I've done is I've essentially created a function called square that accepts any value and will square it. We can see what happens down here. Square 3, for example, means that I'm going to take the value 3 and square it. So how exactly does this work? When I pass power of 2, when I pass 2 into this power of function, this variable y is populated with that value 2. And that is sort of held in memory. That's sort of like held in state somewhere in the computer. We don't really care how or where at this point. But I return this function called exponentiator. And again, it doesn't really matter what this function is called. We can really call it anything. That accepts a double and returns a double, but uses this value y inside of it. So even though it's this function, this exponentiator function that's been returned back to my variable that I called square, it has contained within it this notion of what y was. And it remembers that. So every time I call that function that is now called square, it uses that. But this also means that I can create another variable using a different power of. So I can create a cube variable, for example, provide to it power of 3. Now cube will actually take some value and cube that and return it. So we can see that I get a value 8 out of that. But that value y hasn't changed because they're held in sort of independent variables. They're sort of held in independent spaces in memory. So cube will always have x to the power of 3, and square will always have x to the power of 2, which means that square will always square numbers as I expect, and cube will always cube numbers as I expect. This also means that sometimes you can get some sort of funky looking syntax where you have power of, at the very bottom of the screen here, power of 5, and you pass into the result, you call that function that's been returned with the number 4, and so what essentially this is 4 to the fifth power. We can see the result there. With me so far? So this idea is called a closure, because what we're basically doing is we're encapsulating some data into sort of enclosing this data into a function, and we're being able to reuse this function. Now, this syntax, though, can actually be simplified a great amount. And there's a lot of possibility in Swift for this simplification, and that's what sort of the subsequent ones actually look at. So in 7b, for example, we take this exact same code, but now, rather than actually define a function inside of this power of function and give it a name and then return the name of that function, which then is used as part of this closure, instead, we're just going to simplify it. We don't need this function to be named. So this is the concept of an anonymous function, where we can then accept as input, in parentheses here, x, the variable x, which is of type double. We're going to return the type double. And then the keyword in is the beginning of this function. So notice that all of this is within curly brackets, and we're defining an anonymous function here. Just a simpler way of defining the exact same thing. Okay? But hold on. Swift actually allows us to go further and simplify even more, because really we don't care that this parameter is named any particular thing. It can really be called anything, and we can still use that first parameter. So in fact, there is this special type of data in anonymous functions, or there's this special name of variables in anonymous functions that start with a dollar sign and represent the parameter numbers, zero indexed, for this function. So there's a couple of things going on here. I'm going to return and then a curly brace representing a function. But I notice that I don't have defined the parameter types or the return type. It can actually be inferred because of the signature of this original function. So we can eliminate that as a possibility. But also, I can use $0 to represent this first parameter that's passed into this anonymous function. So simplifying it even more. OK? So far, so good. Now, it's this type. Do you remember this $0 that we saw and this curly brace that we saw just a little while ago in this Swift 6 example? It was right here. Notice that's exactly what we're looking at, is that we have passed into this split function an anonymous function that checks the first parameter to see if it equals the colon symbol. And that's exactly what's happening, is that all we're doing, the return keyword is implied in this case. We are returning this value where we're comparing the first parameter against this character colon. And so that sort of demystifies this. And you're going to see this construct a lot in Swift syntax. So do keep that in mind when you're taking a look at this. Now, we can get off the rails a little bit and go really fancy that shows even some more of Swift's power. You might even see some of these in sample code, so that's why I'm going to show this to you. Basically, what we can do is that, first of all, it was kind of needless for me to implement all of that power of code, because if you import the Darwin library, it actually includes a function called pow that allows you to do this, that does this for you. So we can simplify it even more and have our power of function now just be a wonderful one-liner, where we just return this anonymous function that accepts $0 as its base and y as its exponent. But we can get really, really fancy when we realize that Swift has a lot of power under the hood. A lot of the operators that we've been dealing with, plus signs and division symbols and all of these things that you normally operate with in with data types in a programming language, are actually extensible in Swift. So what that means is that we can define our own operators. So now I'm tired of typing in all this POW and then in parentheses and then the base. I don't want to do that. I actually want to have an operator that allows me to do that, so I can tell Swift that I want to create an operator, star star. By the way, I can't use the caret, because the caret is an operator that does something else entirely. So I don't want to sort of collide with that. And so what you see in a variety of languages, including Python, is like star star operator for to represent exponents, so that's the only reason why I've done that. And it's going to be an infix type operator, and I have to provide to it some information about the precedence of this operator. So it's left associative, it's like relatively high precedence compared to like summation or multiplication, it's higher precedence than all of those, so on and so forth. And then I define the function that actually dictates what this operator does. So assuming that I have a left-hand side and a right-hand side, which would be perhaps a better variable name for this, left-hand side and right-hand side, I can then take this power of the left-hand side to the right-hand side and return that value. So now it's super sweet. All we have to do is 2 star star 3, and that is 2 to the third power, we get a value of 8. 2 star star 10 is 2 to the 10th power, we get 1024. So now our power of function, which again is different because the whole idea behind this was that we have one function that always takes some value and multiplies it to, takes the exponent to the same power. So now it's even simpler. So now it's just $0 star star y. We don't even have to use pow anymore. OK, who's lost? So far, are we doing OK? Any questions on this stuff? Yeah. Func power of y double. Oh, yeah, I don't know what the line numbers are. Sorry about that.
Why are you returning a function sort of enclosure? Isn't $0 star star y, since we just define that as an operator, wouldn't that return double? And then you just return double?
So let me answer your question how I understand it, and you can tell me if I didn't understand your question. So this construct, the curly brace $0 star star y, is a function. And it accepts a parameter that is represented by this $0. The return keyword is implied in this very short anonymous function syntax, which means that essentially what this is saying is that I am defining a function, and then I'll just call it something, where I have some value y. I have y, which is double, and I am returning a double, and I have within that return y, no, sorry, I shouldn't have called this y, x. Oh dear. X, nope, star star y. So this is just a simplified version of this. And so the reason that I have $0 is that using this closure means that I no longer have to type pow, or no longer do I have to do something like 3 star star 2. I can just have a single function called square that will always take some value as input and actually return the square of that. So the whole purpose of the closure is to just sort of encapsulate the fact that I always want to use y whenever I call that function as the power when taking this exponent. So returning then a function that accepts a double, which is the base, and returning the result of that exponent is the key here. And that's the major distinction. There was just a bit of a flourish. This is not any different compared to the prior examples, but it was just a bit of a flourish that we can actually create an operator in Swift and actually do stuff with it, which is kind of a cool thing. Did I answer your question? Sweet. Anything else before we move on? Okay. Now, this sort of begs the question is that, well, OK, now we have the ability for functions to be returned. Can we also pass functions as data or as parameters to other functions? And in fact, we can. So let's say that we have all of this same code. We have the square variable that will square this code, and we have this cube variable that will cube some data. And we actually want to apply it to a wide range of numbers. So what we might be tempted to do, of course, and which is certainly valid, is to iterate over this list of numbers and apply my functions, square and cube, and get 2 new lists as a result that are this original list squared and cubed, respectively. Perfectly acceptable. But what's the thing that we see here is that we have, again, duplication of our code. And there's perhaps an opportunity for us to simplify this a little bit. What if there was a way for us to actually always iterate over some list and just pass to this magical function a variable that represents a function that we want to apply to every single item in this list. This brings up the concept of what are called higher order functions, and that is essentially what this is that we can create a function, and in this case it's called a mapper, just to give it a name, just mapping over every single item in a list, where I take a list and I take a function. And that function, of course, has a certain signature. It accepts as a parameter a double, and it will output as a double. And the whole result of this function is going to be a new list that is of type double. Okay, and what I'm going to do is to apply this function f to every element in my list and return this new list as a result, which is really cool. Now I can pass functions around. And this idea of higher order functions is really important. And this mapper is really just a poor man's implementation of a function that is built into Swift called map. And it does precisely this, perhaps even a little bit better. This is just sort of a generic, simplified version that allows us to see the concept that applies here. Now look at the way that I can actually apply my square and my cube functions to this list of numbers. I run my mapper, I provide to it my list of numbers, I provide to it the function that's going to apply to each of those indices, and it is going to be output as a result. And I will get to see that I've squared and cubed my numbers as a result. And of course, the mapper will take any sort of anonymous function. We can even see that I've created a new anonymous function that just takes some parameter and divides it by 2. And we can see that I've, in fact, divided my list by 2 instead. Cool? So far, so good? All right. Now let's come back to this idea. Let's implement this back in the context of a grade book. And if I do that, we can see that I can apply a wide variety of these options, or wide variety of these higher order functions, to actually simplify my ability to do a variety of things on lists of numbers. So for example, if I take a list of numbers, one of the higher order functions that exists is called reduce. What reduce does, rather than map, is reduce will take two elements in the list. It will take some function that compares the two elements of the list, and it will then sort of output, the output of that function will be another element that you then compare to others. So you could use this to actually sum all of the numbers in your list. For example, if you had a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you take the first two elements, 1 and 2, you can apply to it an addition function that takes those two elements and spits out one of those elements, which would be the value 3. Then we take that value 3 with the next element of the list, sum those two, and then keep going down the list. We're reducing the list to a single value. And it just so happens that the plus symbol is an operator. Just like we just saw, this operator is actually a function that has precisely this list that we would want, or rather these properties that we would want. So I encourage you to take a look at this. I want to sort of move on from some of this code so that we can actually look at some actual, real, true Swift in Xcode in iOS development. But take a look at this and see if you can parse through what's going on with some of these higher order functions, including filter, reduce, and you'll even see somewhere in here map as well. It's right here, where it will take a sequence of grades and it will actually map them using the switch construct, which you might recognize from C, but actually it is a lot more powerful than the switch construct that we have in C. And we'll apply that to every element in the list and actually provide the letter grade of each of those grades, using all of these concepts that we've just talked about before. Now, let's sidestep for just a minute and talk about structs. And so structs are a way in C that we were able to define a new type of data. Structs exist within Swift, and so do a lot of other constructs called enums and classes that really take this idea to a whole different level. And basically, it's just a way of defining a new type of data. So if you come across class or structs or enums, don't get confused by it. It's just a way of defining some new particular type of data. And this is really important when we're talking about iOS app development, because everything that exists within the iOS app is essentially an object of some kind. And an object is basically a class or an enum or a struct. So in this case, I'm defining a new type of data that I'm calling assessment that has some properties, including a name and a sequence of grades. So one type of assessment that I might have in mind would be quizzes, for example. I would want to have an assessment that was a quiz and that it had a variety of grades associated with that for quiz one, quiz two, so on and so forth. Or I might have a different type of assessment for problem sets. And I can do things. I can actually have functions within this type of data, which are now called methods. So if you ever see the word method, it really is just a function that applies to a very specific class or to a very specific type of data and allows us to modify the data within. So in other words, if I want to add a grade to my assessment, then all I need to do is to append the score that was input to this function to my internal property. There's another neat construct here in Swift, which is this dot, dot, dot operator, which means that scores can now accept any number of integers. And scores will be an array of integers that have been passed to my function, which means that I can do stuff like this. I can do add grades and just provide arbitrary numbers of integers into it and actually be provided an array of those values in my function or in my method, as is the case. Now, this is important because everything in Xcode, everything in iOS is in fact an object. So keep that in mind when we bust open Xcode and skip ahead beyond iOS versions 2 and 3 and actually go on to version 4. And again, all of this will be posted on the seminar page. iOS 4 is sort of a full-blown implementation of a very basic app. And what this app does is it loads a UI which looks like this. Again, if we click on Storyboard, we can see that this is what it looks like. This is the UI. It has a title at the very top. I've called it Web Gallery. In the middle, there's an element called a UI Image View. And at the bottom, there's a toolbar with a single button that has stretchy spaces that allow it to center in the middle of this toolbar. And what happens is that when this loads, it downloads a JSON file that's contained on a server elsewhere, parses that JSON file, and the JSON file looks a bit like this. Docs.net. Let's see. The JSON file looks like this. Like this. There it is. It has an album name and it has an array of photos. Each of those photos have a name and also a URL themselves that represent the JPEG version of that individual photo. So what happens is that when this program loads, it downloads this JSON file, parses it, puts all of this into the equivalent of an array in iOS app development, which is an NS array. And then I can then load this data into an application and load it on my screen. There is an image that was loaded with a button at the very bottom. If I click Get Next Image, it then pulls that image from the internet and replaces that image in the UI image view. So you can download this and actually take a look at it on your computer and build it and actually compile it onto your device. But essentially, the process was this. Create the storyboard, or rather not create, but select the storyboard. And we'll take just a couple of seconds to actually show you how this was done. Whoops, not a template. Need to do a new project file. Just so that's how we can actually achieve this is made a little bit more apparent. Single view application. I'm going to call this seminar 4, representing this particular number. Save it on the desktop. Okay, going to click on the storyboard. And what I'm going to do is to find my image view, drag it onto my user interface, and center it. Now, just centering it, unfortunately, is not going to do a whole lot, except for a screen that is this exact size. So we can convince ourselves of that by clicking on this double circle thing, bringing down this pop-up menu here and changing to preview, where we'll actually get a chance to preview how this will actually look on other devices. As we can see, we don't even see it on this particular case, so I'm going to close this for now. And I'm going to select this icon down at the very bottom portion of the screen. It says Resolve Auto Layout Issues. Sorry, it's cut off at the bottom. But if I click on that, what I get is this pop-up. Oh, no, go away. Hold on. what I get is this pop-up that allows me to add missing constraints. And by doing that, it will then sort of lock it into the center portion of the screen like I might expect. Now, in order to get this button on top of it, I need to go to the editor, go to Embed In, and click Navigation Controller. What that will do is that will add this whole other component to it, but it will actually link it back to my original UI. And the details, again, we don't really need to care about right now. But I do want to have a toolbar at the very bottom, so I'll check Shows Toolbar. And this provides within my view, which is now somewhere else. We can see it's linked over here. It now provides a toolbar at the bottom of my UI. So now, rather than selecting an image view, I can find a label, or rather a toolbar. Let's see, where is that? What was it called? A button. Bar button item. Plop that there and apply a couple of flexible spaces on either side to actually center that. So now I've created my UI, basically, and I can give it a name by double-clicking at the very top here and saying Web Gallery and so on. Now again, these are elements that exist by themselves, and I have to connect them to my code, which I can do by, again, bringing up this double circle icon, changing from the preview, which, by the way, now we can see is nicely centered and will look good on a variety of devices. Switch to automatic, which will bring up the view controller code. And now this part is important. In order for you to connect these two elements, your code to the UI, you select the item that you want to connect. So in this case, we actually want to encode, change the image that's contained within this UI image view. So if you control click from the image view and drag, you'll notice that you get a little sort of bar. When you let go of everything, this pop-up will occur. And it says that we'll create a connection. And from here, I want to give it a name of something like gallery. Hit enter. And this actually provides a variable called gallery that I can then reference in my code to change the image, for example. So how does that code actually look? Well, again, don't want to spend too much time on it, and I encourage you to download it and take a look. But one of the most important aspects is the code that actually fetches an image. So in this case, I want to get within my photos array, which is contained within my class. I want to find the name and the URL that's been parsed out of this JSON. Actually ask the device to get the URL, to fetch a URL from this, and then fetch the data from the contents of that URL, then convert that data into an image by passing it into the UI image. So again, these are all different types of objects, different types of classes. And then I can then set my gallery.image equal to that data. And that's sort of the meat of it that actually is then able to change the data from, change the picture from one to the next. So again, hopefully now a lot of the constructs will make a little bit more sense. Notice that there's some exclamation points here. The exclamation points are essentially related to the optionals. What I'm basically saying is that without even checking to see if there's data within this optional, I'm going to go ahead and assume that there is and unwrap it. Remember that we use the analogy of sort of a package for the optionals, and we need to unwrap the package and pull the data out. The exclamation point forces that to actually happen. But I know that this is safe because I've checked to see if image data is equal to nil. I've actually checked to see if that optional was, in fact, failed, if that had, in fact, failed already. And so I'm sure that once I get to this point, I can safely unwrap that data. You might also see it in the form of a question mark. So if we scroll down to where I need to actually parse the data, so don't be put off by these sort of lengthy names. You can find in the Apple's developer cite a lot of references to all of the objects and all of the processes that actually make this possible. But notice that this is essentially a function where I pass it some data, and I get back some sort of data, and I need to use this as keyword to convert it into this NSDictionary question mark, which is, again, an optional NSDictionary, which I then need to check to see if it exists. So I could use that if let successful equals parsed, then I know that that optional actually contains some data. Or as what I did here was to just assume that if there were no errors, that it is in fact safe. All right, I want to thank you all very much for coming. I know this was a lot, but it was only an hour to talk about some pretty advanced stuff. And so hopefully we will, or hopefully you'll get a chance to download all of the code and take a better, more thorough look at it, sort of convince yourself of all of the stuff that's going on. And I want to thank you all again for coming, and good luck with your final projects. Have a great day.